from the voice of the silence. The light from the one master, the one unfading golden light of spirit, shoots its effulgent beams on the disciple from the very first. Its rays thread through the thick, dark clouds of matter. Now here, now there, these rays illuminate like sun sparks light the earth through the thick foliage of the jungle growth. But, O disciple, unless the flesh's passive head cool, the soul as firm and pure as flaming diamond, the radiance will not reach the chamber. Its sunlight will not warm the heart, nor will the mystic sounds of the Akashic Heights reach the ear, however eager, at the initial stage. So when we're looking at this idea of Easter, then we're looking at the idea of light, of sunlight, of spiritual light. And so this first portion of this panel, we are running a panel discussion today. The first talk will be on, the title is Easter, Spiritual and Physical Rebirth. And we'll be looking at this idea of physical rebirth first. And there's a lot more to Easter than we think most people consider. Most people are looking at the idea of maybe getting a new outfit, having family over, special dinner, dyeing Easter eggs, that kind of thing. There's all sorts of Easter related items, especially in drugstores and in markets, just all over. Easter's definitely becoming over the years much more in regards to materialistic ideas. But we wonder how many people actually realize what Easter actually means. And it we look with Easter in regards to cycles. The idea of cycles is, are things repeating themselves, you know, year after year, month after month, you know, eon after eon. And these cycles, when we're looking at this idea of Easter, the seasons, Easter is a celebration of spring. And when we think of spring, it's right after winter, which depends, especially this year in some areas of the country. They're probably welcoming Easter with open, I mean, this time of the year, spring, with open arms because of all the awful winter weather that went on. So this idea of spring then is almost like a happiness. It's a bursting forth of good feelings and physical and emotional. We can look at winter as, when we're looking at winter compared to the cycles of man, winter can be looked at as being the sleep of man. Things are underground. It looks like all the trees are dead. All the buds are gone, but they're really kind of sleeping in a way. The roots underground are resting, shoring up strength and vitality for the spring to burst forth with their flowers and leaves. Seeds, bulbs, everything is resting underground like man is resting during a sleep. And then when spring comes, that can be compared to the young part of somebody's life. That, you know, it comes forth as strong and vital. The leaves are coming out, the seeds are blooming, flowers. It's a beautiful time of year. And people are feeling better. It's cool. We don't have to bundle up. We can walk around, sit outside. And it's just a wonderful time of the year. And then in summer, things are just kind of being maintained, just like, you know, life is just kind of going through its paces, people are taking vacations, that sort of thing. And then things kind of start to decompensate with fall. It's like when people get older, they, you know, things aren't, we're not as strong, we're not as sharp. So things just kind of decompensate. And then we start this all over again in winter. So it's a cycle of man, but it's also a cycle of the earth, as we just said, with spring, summer, autumn, and winter. And the most important thing we need to look at is this idea of the sun. And we found this from a periodical from 1923. They did their quarterly a little bit different than ours, but there's a wonderful reading here. It's called The Return of the Sun. And it's cometh the day when the recurrent cycle of the seasons brings us nearer to the sun. He seems to return to the earth, when in truth it is our own inclination brings us more directly under his influence. Then the dead earth and the sleeping life are quickened, and all things reproduce after their kind. Without the sun, they are and yet are not. In this hour of its isolation, with no more any outward thing to lean upon it, let the soul incline towards the spiritual sun of all, and it will seem to draw near and yet near till the vernal impulsion quickens the whole nature from within, without, as the physical sun warms and woos the life from without, within. For every solar system, its sun, so that the teeming planets are never in an unredeemable winter. So we're looking at this idea of the physical sun as being imperative to the life of man, and not of man only, but of the earth. So, the Hindus have had their savior, which is representative of the sun, Vishnu. But internationally, the sun is a symbol that people honor, especially in spring, because we're looking at the return of the sun starting with the solstice in December. Then the sun starts to get, we can see it. Like every few days, we'll look at outside and say, oh my goodness, it's 6 o'clock and it's, you know, it's still light. And then as the days get longer and we get to the vernal equinox and the sun, the length of the day and the shortness of the day are equal, but it's a bursting forth of energy, of life that the sun creates. And this is basically what Easter is all about. And when we get to this idea of the symbols, we'll be able to see how, in fact, this is an international and it's ancient, the celebration of spring. Of course, it hasn't always been called Easter, but there has always been an honoring of the return of the sun, a celebration of it. And Easter actually was not really celebrated until 150 years after the death of Christ. And the date was not set until the 3rd century. And up until then, it really was what they call a movable feast. And the word Easter is from a Scandinavian word for spring, Ostara, a symbolism of resurrection and new life. And the goddess Ishtar, another root word for Easter, was said to be hatched out of an egg representing the power that gives life. But it's always, this time of year, has always been celebrated as a rite of spring. Even Passover, even, you know, there is that usual idea of Passover, but in reality, it's celebrated in spring, and it originally was the celebration of the sun. And in some areas up to the 19th century, the sunrise was observed on Easter morning to celebrate the lengthening of the sunlight. And this ritual, again, was performed in many religions. And we know that a lot of churches have what they call sunrise celebrations of it. So, and also when we're talking about the sun coming back, the farmers, there's a celebration in the agriculture area, because this is in spring is when a lot of their animals are giving birth to young. They're digging up the soil, they're planting the seeds, they're harvesting some items that were able to manage through the winter. So there is so much to look at when we think of the sun in Easter. And Easter was the celebration of the spring festival at the vernal equinox, spring which resurrects life, spring which is the symbol of birth or rebirth, cosmic and human, celestial and terrestrial. In regards to Passover, we know that Moses was considered an initiate. He taught a lot of ideas about soul truth and deliverance from bondage. And we can look at this idea of bondage as being the bondage of winter. And then spring is that release from that. And breaking out of this idea of materialism. Next to the sun, one of the major symbols of Easter is that of the egg. And we could have a whole class on what the egg means, but we're only going to touch on a few basic ideas. And of course, the egg is an analogy for the human, womb. As the fetus grows, it is surrounded by darkness, just like in the egg. And it's protected by the mother because, birds, they sit and roost on the eggs. But when the time comes, life emerges from the egg. And we know that if a human like would help a chick come out of the egg, many times that chick will not survive because it builds strength as it's, tapping away at the shell to break it and struggling through. But if a human would help it, it may not live. And there's many universal ideas in India. It is thought that Brahmanda, the universe, is the egg. And spirit places the germ of life into the womb, the golden womb. It's the symbol of purity and vitality. And the Hindus talk about what is known as the mundane egg. And that mundane egg, one of the most universally adopted symbols, highly suggestive as it is equally in the spiritual cycle, physiological and cosmological sense. It is found in every world. It's chosen as the symbol representation of the universe, of our earth. It's a circle and a sphere, and the shape of our globe must have been known from the beginning and some symbology since it was so universally adopted. And this is from the Secret Doctrine regarding that mundane egg. And the egg, also the Greeks, the Phoenicians, Japanese, the North and South American tribes, even the savages of the remotest islands, this idea of the egg and spring is common throughout. The shell is looked at as being the sky, the white part, the air and sea, the yolk and the earth. And it's interesting about this, the idea of coloring eggs. That also is a symbol, because we look at the white light from the sun going through a prism and breaking up into the primary colors, and all the diversity that comes through with this idea of the white light coming through and splitting up through the prism. And well, one more and then we'll close. And the crucifixion of Jesus represents two ideas, which is the same two ideas as Easter, that of death and resurrection. And this is a very ancient initiation ceremony when we look at this symbology of the cross. It is said that the neophyte, when he is being initiated, is put into a cave. And there's a table there that is shaped like a cross, and he is laid down on it and is kept there for 3 days. And there is a blockage put in front of the cave, the rock that we know of in regards to Jesus's resurrection. And when the neophyte emerges and he is reborn, moves the rock aside. So it's like, it is symbolic of our evolution, of our spiritual evolution that can happen as well. The cross also, since most of the time it's made from a tree, it is the symbol of the sacred and secret knowledge. Spirit is crucified by earthly passions, buried in the sepulcher of flesh and the stone of matter covering the inner man. Man is crucified on the cross of matter, spirit and matter. And it is the death of the old and resurrection of the rebirth of the new man. So there are many other symbols that we can talk about during the meeting, but we think that we have covered most of the highlights, and we will go on with our second speaker.
This second presentation covers the idea of the spiritual rebirth connected with spring and Easter. So we'll begin by just repeating one or two of the ideas presented already. And we understand that Easter is the time of the physical rebirth of nature in the spring in the Northern Hemisphere, marked by the vernal equinox between March 19th and March 21st. It is the time of the year when the hours of daylight and darkness are equal and the direct rays of the sun fall directly upon the equator. And we know this is due to the fact that there's a natural inclination of the earth, and as the earth moves around the sun, different parts of the northern or southern hemisphere receive more or less direct rays. And at the time of the vernal equinox, those rays fall directly over the equator. And so we perceive that the hours of daylight and night are the same. Well, that's Easter from a terrestrial and perhaps astronomical point of view. But it is, we know, a holiday for Christians. It is the time of year when they reverently celebrate the resurrection of their Savior, Jesus Christ. And it is very natural for them to celebrate the resurrection of their Savior in associationship with the sun and what goes on at this time of the year. It is interesting that in the earliest depictions of Christ, we see images of him with a solar orb radiating above his head, identifying him as a sun god. And we know that the sun gods in all traditions are born around the time of the winter solstice, around December 21st. So the light of the sun seems to be reborn or resurrected in the spring in all its glory after the death of winter in the Northern Hemisphere. And this is sort of synthesizing what we've learned in our first presentation. So now we want to move this to the idea that this idea of the Savior, who is the object of reverence, is not unique to Christianity. As it was mentioned before, the Hindus have their Savior connected with the sun, Vishnu, who is also reverently invoked, and we read about it in the Puranas. And in that work, we hear these words: "Glory to the unchangeable, holy, eternal, supreme Vishnu, of one universal nature, the mighty over all. To Vishnu, the cause of final emancipation, the cause of creation, existence, and the end of the world, who is the root of the world, and who also consists of the world." So, like Christians, with their Christ, Hindus associate their Savior, Vishnu, with the sun, and declare that the sun is of a sevenfold nature. And we read about that in the Vishnu Purana in these words: "Vishnu, in the form of his active energy, never either rises or sets, and is at once the sevenfold sun and distinct from it." Now, Theosophy puts forth this ancient universal idea of the sevenfold nature of the sun, the sevenfold nature of the human being. And so that is a more complete description of the basic idea that we recognize that man or the human being is both an objective physical being, but there is a hidden part of man which is much more complex, and that sevenfold nature, that invisible part of the human being, makes up the totality. So what is the meaning then of this sevenfold sun? So the sun as a human being is sevenfold. The objective physical sun that we see and feel, just as the gross physical body of the human being, is the lowest aspect of the physical sun. And that sun is a reflection of the real sun, or its highest aspect. And that highest aspect of the sun has been called or described as the universal presence of life and light. The one universal presence of life and light, the first manifestation of the ever unmanifested absolute all. So we might say that there is a spiritual sun, which is hidden, and the objective sun, just as there is a spiritual nature to the human being and a physical, observable, tangible nature to the human being. So we understand that the physical sun is the source of light and heat for our solar system, the worlds of our solar system. But this spiritual sun, this sun, is also like the heart, which pumps the force of spiritual and physical life and light throughout the body of the solar system. So it might be likened to the heart in the body, which pumps life-giving blood throughout the body. This spiritual and physical sun together give forth to the universe, to the solar system, spiritual as well as physical life and light. So now we move into the spiritual rebirth at this time of year. So we can see that this real, invisible, hidden sun, this spiritual sun, corresponds to the higher self, spirit, Atma, the Christos principle in the human being. The higher self is the source of life and light, spiritual for the human being, just as the spiritual sun is the source of those kinds of forces for the solar system. The Christos principle, the higher self, Atma, like Vishnu, is the real hidden sun in the human being. And like that invisible sun, we can never see it. Yet it is the savior within and the cause of our final liberation. Like Vishnu, the Christos principle is the creator and preserver of our conscious life in spirit, the destroyer of ignorance and illusion, and the regenerator of spiritual knowledge in the mind. At Easter, and this is probably the most important idea we can take from this morning, at Easter, the vernal equinox, the light of the physical sun becomes more present in the northern hemisphere, and all nature responds with renewed spiritual, with renewed physical life, because the earth and is inclined to receive that at this time of the year. Correspondingly, and here's the point, the light of the Christos principle, the higher self, the human spiritual sun, is felt more strongly in the minds of those turned within and toward the higher self. The spiritual influence and wisdom of the higher self is more present in the mind. And we just wanted to read a brief passage from the Voice of the Silence regarding that. Alas, alas, that all men should possess Alaya, to be one with the great soul, and that possessing it, Alaya should so little avail them. Behold, how like the moon reflected in the tranquil waves, Alaya is reflected by the small and by the great, is mirrored in the tiniest stones, yet fails to reach the heart of all. Alas, that so few men should profit by the gift, the priceless boon of learning truth, the right perception of existing things, the knowledge of the non-existent. So although the light of the higher self is always there, it is felt more strongly at this time in the hearts of human beings, which is the source of the feeling, the psychic and spiritual uplifting that people have felt throughout the ages at this time of year. It's a gift of nature, a cyclic return of an impression. And for those who aspire, it is a great opportunity provided by great nature and the inner human nature for a spiritual rebirth and resurrection from the darkness of ignorance, materialism, and separateness. And for those who aspire to be true servants of humanity, they can be, like the sun, the center of their little solar system of family, friends, and acquaintances, from which proceeds a spiritual influence and wisdom for the benefit of all. So we'll stop here and invite your questions and comments on these ideas.
Yeah. Okay, MDW, unmute. Yes.
It seems that this holiday alludes to light as being the one factor in the universe that we all display or we're all looking for, or that light of knowledge, or that just that light. And it seems to me that it's speaks of man as if we're that light, we have within us the full potential of all that exists, and that we are so enamored by our material existence that we do not see anymore this light. You mentioned that this is a season when we all feel the uplifting. We all could feel it. There's something going on. And when we look outside, we see what's going on. Everything is being reborn. So I guess it's alluding to the fact of reincarnation as well.
And when we're looking at this idea of rebirth, of course, rebirth also with reincarnation, is the sun, if we didn't have the sun, you know, everything would die. And for whatever reason, humans don't deal well in living in the dark. And, you know, we know that there are animals that function at night, but humans, by and large, need the daytime, need the light in order to feel better. There's a fear of the dark for humans. And so we need the sunlight in order to function, to live. The plants need light so that we have food to eat. Our animals can eat the food because of the sun. So it is a physical reality, but also when we, as was just said in the previous talk, spiritually, it's a rebirth of our soul. And just to feel better, and to try, as was said now about, you know, materialism, it would be, the rebirth would be to cut away from that materialism.
So the ancient universal idea was that light and life, like everything else, is sevenfold. There are various aspects of it, visible and invisible. And this shouldn't seem so strange for us, because even in this physical world, we understand that there is light that human beings can see and can't see. There's the whole spectrum of light we call infrared that we more often feel rather than see. And then there is ultraviolet light. And we know there are aspects of that light which are perceptible to insects, but not to human beings. And so if there is light visible and invisible, even on this plane, light must have a greater aspect than we can understand. We speak of the light of our energy. It makes us feel alive. We speak the light of our passions. The light of our understanding and reason, the light of our intuitions, the light of our realization that we are eternal spiritual beings. So light, illumination, has various aspects. And when we perceive it, or when it affects of it, the effects of this light is it energizes, it gives us life. So we have a life of spirit, a life of the mind, a life of our senses, a life of our passions, a life of our physical body. But it's all coming forth from this life principle, this light principle, which comes from the higher, ultimately, the spiritual aspect. of nature.
I have a question over here.
We were wondering that Easter is the first Sunday after the first full moon in spring. So it is a movable feast in a sense. There's a little bit of movement. What does the moon have to do with Easter? Because it seems to revolve around the moon. It's the first Sunday after the first full moon in spring.
We're not sure about the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have this phrase here in the Voice of the Silence. Behold how like the moon reflected in the tranquil waves. What is the moon? In a sense, it is a representative of the sun during the night time. When the sun is obscured from our view, the reflected light of the moon illuminates. And we all know of the power of that moonlight, not only to illuminate the way in darkness, but we know that the moonlight, it's been reported, can have an effect on our psychic nature. It's interesting, we take all these ideas of the sun and the moon, there is a certain relationship between the natural cycles of the human being. And one of the interesting aspects of Easter that we may not realize, yes, it comes from that Scandinavian word Ostara, but that Ostara or Easter is also the root of the word estrogen. The hormone, which is very important for the fertility of the woman. And so from that, in the womb, the egg is dropped and we have through that estrogen, the fertility, the life to bring forth a child in the same way. The sun gives light and life and nourishment to the plants, and even the moonlight has an effect on the prospering and the vegetation, the life of the vegetation on this planet. So very interesting that how we see these correspondences, even in our language, between what goes on in nature and what goes on in a cosmic sense. And that's pretty much what Easter is about, acknowledging that it's a universal event that is felt in the heart of all human beings and in nature.
One of the interesting things that we discovered about all the different traditions of Easter, they all seem to be able to be taken back in their essence to something spiritual. We mentioned something about the eggs and dyeing the eggs, but have people ever considered why there's the Easter egg hunt? What is that whole thing with the hiding of the egg? And it has been said symbolically, it's like it's the hidden, as one of the commenters was talking about, how we're so committed to materialism, and that if we can get rid of the materialism and focus on the spiritual, we can find ourselves again. So this is like finding the egg, finding life again, finding spiritual life again. And we just thought that was interesting about what the whole thing came out of just hiding the eggs.
Well, as was pointed out, that life and light is very often hidden from our view and in darkness. Once again, we read in the voice of the silence, "If sun thou canst not be, then be the humble planet. And if thou art debarred from flaming like the noonday sun upon the snow-capped mount of purity eternal, then choose, O neophyte, a humbler course. Point out the way, however dimly, and lost among the host, as does the evening star to those who tread their path in darkness. Give light and comfort to the toiling pilgrim, and seek out him who knows still less than thou, who in his wretched desolations sits starving for the bread of wisdom and the bread which feeds the shadow." So it is very often hidden from view. And besides the traditions of the saviors of different nations and civilizations who bring forth through their life and works and teachings a reawakening of the awareness of this spiritual aspect of our nature, we have the benefit of working with and associating other human beings of like mind. And through that association and exchange, we help rekindle, rediscover that hidden source of wisdom within our natures.
MDW.
Well, when you say recover this knowledge, from what we hear in Theosophy is that if we have been reincarnating, you know, this is not the first time that we have been here. And that, and it also says that we have been in, we've been incarnating together for 18 millions of years. That goes beyond the scope of any Christianity or any Judaism. That we must have buried deep within us a recognition of this, of what's going on, of this light coming forth. And so the idea that comes forward is that we look at this in a very particular way, but this is a very universal idea. And it points to man being the light, and that that we attain that through a selfless service to mankind.
Well, certainly the idea of reincarnation is not foreign to Judaism. It is found pretty centered and prominent in the Kabbalistic teachings, as well as in the mystical teachings of Judaism, and as well as Christianity is concerned, up until the Council of Constantinople in the 5th century, the teachings of reincarnation were part of the early Christian doctrine until the doctrine of preexistence was declared anathema, and along with it, reincarnation. So it's been hidden from view, but it is there. And it can be drawn out because it's been a true idea cannot be completely hidden, but like the spring ever forces itself to reappear again and again. And so we have down through the ages, even in these last 1,000 years, individuals in different parts of the world from different traditions who who rediscover, promulgate, and teach these ideas, these same ideas of reincarnation, karma just being a part of that understanding of the law of the cyclic return of the causes we set up in motion. And how is what is the mystery of karma and reincarnation at this time of year, the Easter? Well, just as the seeds in the earth, germinating in the earth, hibernating in the earth at the time of the winter solstice in December 21st, get their vivification and blossom forth and fructify and appear in the spring too. So too, the ideas that we hold are like seeds. And at certain times in our life, when the conditions are right in our nature, just like in great nature, they blossom forth. And we see the fruit of our previous thoughts and actions. Sometimes those seeds come forth as weeds, because that was the nature of the seed. And sometimes it comes forth real wisdom. And the benefit of the summer and the autumn, of course, is that we get to see the full flowering of that crop of weeds and blooms. And then in the fall, we can begin to wean them away, separate the wheat from the chaff, discard the seeds, and prepare for a new cycle, a new harvest of new ideas at the time of the new year. So it's a cycle of life.
We have a chat that came in. We have two of them.
Okay.
The first one is, occult means hidden. Only those from outside who won't accept the hidden are orthodox in their approach, have taken the word occult and turned the word into something meant to be suspect, dangerous, which is how the mass consciousness comes to be one that condemns what they fail to see. Yeah, if you don't understand it, you're going to condemn it, it seems. And occult now, in this day and age, really is a negative thought. It is something people think of it as something evil.
Very good point. What is it that inspires or aggravates the hate and fear we have for other human beings? It's because their motives, their real nature, is hidden to us, is occult to us. And sometimes all we see is the outward expression, and we misjudge based on that, on experience, and we condemn. We fear that which we do not know, and we fear another human being because they don't know. We don't know how they will respond to us. Will they abuse, or will they accept graciously our efforts? And we fail to see their spiritual nature at times because we are too much enamored and focused on their outer defects. And so we can hate and fear what is hidden to us, what we don't know or understand. And as was pointed out by the chat, we tend to bring that as a prejudice against those ideas in different religions, which are generally hidden from you. There was another chat that came in.
Yes, the second one kind of goes along with what we're now discussing. What would be the best way to bring to light the real feelings or thoughts that our friends and neighbors may have about us? Perhaps being too polite to admit, too hesitant to make defensive, too kind to be critical. So we're thinking that what the question is like, how do we get the people that we know to be more honest with us in regards to how they feel about us?
whatever inspires trust. We'll do that. And interestingly enough, trust not only brings out the best, it brings out the worst of another human being because they trust to share with us their nature. What, or not necessarily their real nature, but feelings that they would otherwise hide and not want others to know. So whatever we can do to inspire trust, safety, relationship, may be a way of doing that. Doesn't mean it's easy, but that's one way of doing it.
And being an example, we would think, that of helping others, being, you know, good to others, and just being an example of what is positive in the world, we think might be able to help as well. Mm-hmm.
You know, before we sort of gave a bad rap to weeds, and we did want to balance that out, because we know there are some very beautiful weeds in nature that bring forth beautiful flowers. Problem with weeds very is sometimes they don't know their place, and they overtake the life and intermeddle with the lives of other beautiful flowers. So in dealing with human beings, we may want to recognize what we recognize as a weed or a defect in another human being eventually may flower. They may change. Bring forth good fruit. We might even learn from it. We cannot discard it too quickly, but be patient, give it time to sow forth, because it comes from the same soil that the flower did. And maybe it's just a question of knowledge for that person, knowing how to express their nature with wisdom rather than ignorantly. Because even our good intentions can act like weeds. We can smother the opportunities of others to grow through overexuberance of good intention. And it can be like, act like a weed until we learn how to control it, how to nurture it. So we did want to conclude our meeting with a final reading of the Voice of the Silence. On this whole idea, which relates to the whole idea of this time of year and the Savior. Remembering once again that these verses come from very ancient sources. No conqueror of sins, once that a Sewanee hath crossed the seventh path, all nature thrills with joyous awe and feels subdued. The silver star now twinkles out the news to the night blossoms. The streamlet to the pebbles ripples out the tale. Dark ocean waves will roar it to the rocks surf bound. Scent-laden breezes sing it to the vales, and stately pines mysteriously whisper, a master has arisen, a master of the day. He standeth now like a white pillar to the west, upon whose face the rising sun of thought eternal poureth forth its first most glorious waves. His mind, like a becalmed and boundless ocean, spreadeth out in shoreless space. He holdeth life and death in his strong hand. Yea, he is mighty, the living power made free in him, that power which is himself, can raise the tabernacle of illusion high above the gods, above great Brahm and Indra. Now he shall surely reach his great reward. Thank you very much for joining us this Easter morning, and we look forward to seeing you again.